Welcome to the Swiss Info Podcast, a roundup of the biggest stories from this week in Switzerland, plus the business and cultural highlights.
Hello and thanks for downloading Swiss Info's podcast for August the 8th. I'm Thomas Stevens. It's a controversial podcast this week, focusing on the Beijing Olympic Games and the 10th anniversary of Switzerland's soul-searching decision to pay back assets to Holocaust victims.
Switzerland repeatedly violated its own neutrality. It did so by accepting what it knew to be looted gold bars.
Now, the opening ceremony for the Games of the 29th Olympiad, to give them their formal title, started a couple of hours ago in Beijing, and very impressive they were too. China's Olympic organisers spent 7 years and millions of francs devising and perfecting the opening ceremony, which the country's leaders hope will finally draw attention away from concerns over pollution, security, and human rights that have been making headlines for the past few months. Attendance and non-attendance at the opening ceremony was a hotly debated issue, as human rights groups urged leaders to boycott the Games to protest against China's crackdown in Tibet in May and its ties with the government in Sudan. Nevertheless, Swiss President Pascal Couchepin ignored pro-Tibetan organisations in Switzerland, which had collected 60,000 signatures calling on him to boycott the ceremony. Couchepin justified his decision by saying Switzerland was home to the headquarters of the International Olympic Committee and other international sports federations, so it is only natural, he said, that the Swiss president attend the opening of the Games. He also wanted to cheer on the 84 Swiss athletes hoping to improve on the 5 medals they won in Athens 4 years ago.
I'm here because I believe it's important that the Swiss authorities show the Swiss athletes that they share their hopes and that they are very proud of them.
Swiss President Pascal Couchepin. One Swiss medal favourite is Roger Federer, who is carrying his country's flag on his 27th birthday. Federer said on August the 7th,
"It's going to be a really special birthday for me, carrying the Swiss flag at the opening ceremony. I'm going to take a break from training tomorrow and really enjoy the day. I've trained really hard for the past few days, and I want to be ready for the start of the tournament. I'm looking forward to tomorrow. It's going to be great."
However, criticism of the International Olympic Committee for giving the Games to a country with an incontrovertibly bad human rights record continues. Adolf Ogi, a former Swiss president and former top United Nations sport official, said he rejected calls for a boycott, but believed the IOC had made mistakes.
"As far as I'm aware, it was a strategic decision to choose quiet diplomacy. However, I believe that with China, you need active, aggressive diplomacy. It should have been clearly stated that these are the problems that the Olympics could solve. For example, improving the infrastructure or the air pollution. But then there are the problems that politicians haven't solved that we at the IOC also can't solve. For example, Tibet, the issue of human rights, perhaps also the free movement of people and media freedom. Had these concerns been clearly communicated, and had we said we'd sort out this and the Chinese would sort out that, or that can't be solved, then we wouldn't now face this barrage of criticism."
Why does the IOC repeatedly attract so much criticism?
Maybe it lacks the right diplomats. Today it is represented in many cases by the presidents of the various international sports associations. These people obviously represent first and foremost their own interests, with the great Olympic idea coming second.
Was it a mistake to give China the 2008 Olympic Games?
We shouldn't forget that Beijing lost the Sydney Games in 2000 by just one vote. China was going to get it sooner or later. But perhaps the difficulties connected to the Games were underestimated.
Former top UN sport official Adolf Ogi not admitting it was a mistake to give the Olympic Games to China. Now a less critical look at this week's news. Staying in Beijing, Swiss canoeist Mike Kurt got a shock when a stone bore a football-sized hole in his hull during training. Fortunately, the Swiss team's coach apparently used to build his own canoes when he was young and somehow plugged the gap with some DIY magic. Marcel Burger, one of 8 Swiss sharpshooters in Beijing, says working as a gunsmith when he's not chasing medals is a double-edged sword. It's obviously an advantage for keeping up with the latest technology, he says, but he also finds himself delivering his products to his international rivals. and now a police mystery involving an Olympic appetite. On August the 3rd, Spanish police launched a search for a Swiss food fan who was eating his way around the world's 68 restaurants which had three Michelin stars. 46-year-old Pascal Henry, a motorcycle messenger in Geneva, had not been seen since disappearing from the renowned El Bulli near Barcelona on July the 12th, the 40th stop on his global gastronomic tour. A restaurant spokeswoman did not think Henri had fallen from the clifftop terrace, as someone would have heard something. She also doubted he had fled without paying, as he left behind a notebook with a menu handwritten by each of the three-star chefs who had served him. Media reports said Henri had a reservation for June the 14th at the Arzac restaurant in San Sebastian, but failed to show up. On August the 7th, Interpol reported that Henri had been spotted back in Geneva, but no further details were available. It's known that living off McDonald's every day for a month does funny things to your body. Perhaps the same is true at the other end of the culinary spectrum, and Henri simply couldn't face 28 more five-course meals. It's 10 years since Switzerland's two largest banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, agreed to a $1.25 billion settlement to end a class action suit filed by Jewish organisations and Holocaust victims. Robert Brooks reports.
The suit, filed in Brooklyn, New York, alleged that the Swiss banks knowingly retained and concealed assets of Holocaust victims and collaborated with and aided Nazi Germany. One of the negotiators in talks with Switzerland was Stuart Eisenstadt, who had various senior positions within the Clinton administration. In 2003, he published a book called Imperfect Justice, which had a subtitle, Looted Assets, Slave Labour, and the Unfinished Business of World War II. Its controversial English cover, showing a Swiss flag covered by a swastika of gold bars, upset many Swiss, to the extent that former cabinet minister Joseph Deiss even explored the possibility of stopping its publication. After the book came out, I asked Eisenstadt in his lawyer's office in Washington how he reacted to the Swiss anger.
I was very hurt and pained by it because, to me, the cover had a very clear meaning, and that is that one of the major theses of the book and of the work that I did was the role of the Swiss National Bank in accepting looted Nazi gold, gold bars, throughout the course of the war, despite frequent and repeated efforts by the U.S. government and the Allies to stop that. And then after the war, when they could have given it all back for the refugees and for rebuilding Europe, negotiating for 6 years and giving only a very fraction back.
You've praised the work of historian Jean-François Berger for his comprehensive report on Switzerland's past. But even he says the cover of your book is wrong and outrageous because it suggests that Switzerland was the Nazis' accomplice during the Second World War. How have you reacted to that?
The fact is that Switzerland had a very mixed role during the war, and perhaps it's time for the Swiss people to come to terms with that and to come to terms with the Berger report itself. The fact is that, according to the Berger report, Switzerland repeatedly violated its own neutrality. It did so by shipping arms to Germany. It did so by having its companies employ slave labor. It did so by putting a J stamp on visas that prevented Jewish refugees from coming into the country. And most important, it did so by accepting what it knew to be looted gold bars from the countries that were occupied. To me, the meaning is very clear. I'm sorry if Mr. Berger has a different opinion. I respect his work. And indeed, I think the most important thing is for people to read the book and read the Berger report and then come to terms with their own history.
You have harsh words in your book about what you called the passivity of the Swiss government over the whole dormant accounts issue. Why do you say that?
Of all the major negotiations that I had with Switzerland, with Germany, with Austria, with France, the Swiss bank affair was the only one in which the government itself refused to negotiate. In all the other cases, the German government negotiated along with its private sector. The Austrian government negotiated along with its private sector. The French government negotiated with its private sector, and indeed not only negotiated with, but each of those governments made substantial contributions to the settlement of the class action suits. In the Swiss case, the private Swiss banks were left with the full burden of paying $1.25 billion. And frankly, much of the, I think, criticism of Switzerland during the war can be directed not at the private banks, who were not permitted to take gold, but at the Swiss National Bank, which contributed nothing to the settlement, and neither did the government.
In the whole Holocaust issue, not just Switzerland, but the whole issue of the Holocaust, there's still much to be done, you say.
There is much to be done, and frankly, most of that is occurring outside of Switzerland, not inside of Switzerland. For example, there is still a tremendous amount of confiscated communal property, synagogues, churches, schools, community centers, even cemeteries in Eastern Europe, in the old East Bloc, which have yet to be returned to the religious communities, in particular the Jewish communities, but as well the Catholic and Protestant and other communities. Second, there is a great deal to be done in terms of art restitution in the United States, in Germany, and in particular in Russia. Next is Holocaust education. There are 16 countries, from Sweden to Poland, France to Germany, the United States, which are trying to encourage more Holocaust education in school systems, not as a way of looking back at a morbid past, but the lessons of the Holocaust. What happens when good countries often stand aside in the face of genocide, when good people don't intervene? So I think these are all areas where progress needs to be made.
Stuart Eisenstadt talking to Robert Brooks. Thanks for listening. Learn more about these stories at swissinfo.ch. Turn on, tune in, and download again next week for more Swiss news and views. I'm Thomas Stevens.